Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The new D.C. emergency crime bill is just one step away from becoming law, awaiting the mayor's signature. There's a lot to the bill. We're going to take a deep dive tonight. The mayor and supporters of the bill have called the rising crime issue in D.C. an emergency, also calling it an emergency. Ward 2 D.C. Council Member Brooke Pinto, sponsor of the updated legislation that passed yesterday. She joins me tonight along with Washington Post reporter Keith Alexander. Lines are open if you have a comment or a question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Council Member Pinto, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thanks so much, Harold, for having me.
Absolutely. Keith, always good to talk to you again.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Council Member, first of all, any word on when you expect the mayor to sign this bill?
I think the bill should be signed any day now. I'm very pleased that Mayor Bowser is in full support of this bill and expect it to be signed expeditiously so that it can take effect expeditiously.
Speaking of taking effect, can you briefly explain for our listeners who really don't have an understanding of how this bill works as far as emergency legislation? It's only going to be for 90 days, and it does not have to address congressional approval. Why is that?
That's right. So procedurally, I'm working on a permanent piece of legislation that really tackles a broader array of issues that we're seeing in our community that I hope will improve public safety, everything from increasing efforts to prevent violence, to end cycles of violence, to ensure our returning citizens have what they need to better reenter society successfully after they've served their sentence, other accountability measures. These measures we passed yesterday were really things that I believed could not wait, and happy to get into those, but procedurally, it will be in effect for 90 days. We also passed a temporary piece of legislation, which is the same substance, and that is in effect for 225 days, which gives us a few more months to work out the language for a permanent piece of legislation.
Do you think that you may have issues with lawmakers who are not necessarily fans of D.C. on Capitol Hill once a permanent piece of legislation is passed by the council?
My plan and strategy is going to be very upfront with our congressional partners and congressional opponents to say, look, here's what we're doing. Here's what we're trying to focus on in addressing crime. Happy to answer any questions. I think one of the things that we saw with the revised Criminal Code Act that they overturned our law for the first time in 40 years in a really unacceptable and frustrating manner that was seeking to modernize our criminal code, was that a lot of their pieces of opposition were really optical and not based on substance. And so I'm going to make sure that they have the substance they need to know that what we put forward is going to be a good thing to improve public safety.
As you know, there was a hit-and-run death at 17th and Constitution, just this afternoon, a tourist from Philadelphia was killed. A week ago today, a tourist from Kentucky was killed on the campus of Catholic University. Are you concerned about two tourist deaths in 7 days and the impact on visitors to the city? And what impact, if any, do you believe this legislation will have on that?
So, yes, I am extremely concerned and heartbroken by those deaths. I would say my first and foremost focus is on the impact public safety has on D.C. residents and the 127 people who we've lost to homicide this year alone so far in 2023. And that affects D.C. residents and families, and it also affects visitors as the nation's capital. And so we should all be on the same page here that what is currently working, what's currently in play is not working effectively. And we all have to work together to combat it because it's not acceptable. So this bill does a couple of things that I think will help this summer. First, it expands the camera rebate program so that private residents can apply to get more of these cameras to put on your own property, which if there is a crime, you can help if you'd like. It's still up to the camera holder to submit that footage to the police to help us close more cases. It also creates a standalone offense for discharging a firearm in the public, which is right now not a standalone offense. It right sizes our pretrial detention allowance. We have a presumption of innocence until proven guilty in this city and in this country. And in D.C., you are released pretrial after you've been charged, awaiting your trial, with two exceptions. One, if you're deemed a flight risk, meaning you might not show up to the trial. And two, if you're deemed a danger to the community. And my view is how we've been describing danger to the community is not sufficient for what we're seeing with carjackings, with assaults with intent to kill or deadly weapons. And so it just clarifies that definition to ensure that people can be held pre-trial when they're committing the most violent crimes in our city.
Keith, I have one more. Go right ahead, real quick. Yeah.
So, Council, let me hit right there on that part right there, pre-trial. Explain exactly what's going to be different. As you know, I cover crime, and I have not seen an increase of individuals who are out on pre-trial release committing or reoffending. So I'm curious as to, A, what statistics are you using to support this change, and exactly how this change is going to be different?
So I will say, first and foremost, when I became the chair of the Judiciary Committee this January, I started attending meetings in what's called the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. And this is our law enforcement partners locally and federally who get together every month. It's myself, the mayor, the chief of police, the public defender,
the examiner.
You know, and we talk about what's going on in the city with crime and possible solutions. And one of the things that became very concerning to me was how difficult it was in our statute to hold someone pretrial, which in practice for most cases is a good thing. It's a good thing that in D.C. we don't hold people pretrial unnecessarily for petty crimes or failure to pay tickets. That's an extremely helpful and good reform.
Based on allegations, right? These are not convictions, but these are allegations that are being levied against individuals. Allegations.
Right. Well, there are allegations with probable cause to make an arrest, and then a charging decision has been made, which is following a hearing with a judge and with the court and with a prosecutor and a defender. So these are still rebuttable presumptions if you've already overcome all those other levels of analysis that I went through. But in terms of your question, Keith, about statistics, one thing that was very concerning to me as I started looking more deeply into this spring is that in just the first 3 months of 2023, we had over 100 cases of people who were released on pretrial and committed another violent crime. And so this solution is not going to tackle all crime in the city. I also don't mean to suggest that everybody who is out on pretrial release is a danger to the community. But I tried to structure it in a targeted enough way to address the emergency that we're seeing to suggest, hey, if you commit a really egregious crime of violence, that should be a consideration a judge is making to determine if you're a threat to the community.
Where is that 100 number coming from? Is that from Pretrial Service Agency? Where do you get that 100 number?
Yes, exactly. That's from the Pretrial Services Agency, who we work closely with, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about D.C.'s emergency crime bill passed by the D.C. Council yesterday, awaiting the mayor's signature. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Councilmember Pinto, as you know, Ward 4 Councilmember Janice Lewis George was very vocal after the vote yesterday about the pre-trial detention issue, concerns about mass incarceration. You know, that term has been batted around for many, many, many years, and she said this could disproportionately affect Black people in the city. How do you respond to her concerns?
Well, look, I have a lot of respect and admiration for Councilmember Lewis George. We work together very effectively on a number of different matters, and I take her concerns really seriously. It's exactly why I did not include any penalty enhancements in this emergency bill, because I think when we're talking about increased penalties and what we're doing with sentences, it's important to be focused on the research and how it's going to accommodate our entire criminal code to be fair and just and proportional. I think that's one of the lessons that we've learned from the 80s and 90s of people and judges giving out these sentences, 30, 40, 50 lifetime sentences for crimes that we now know deserve to be have a penalty, that are very serious crimes, but that people also deserve a chance to be rehabilitated and come home and reenter society. And so I take those concerns really seriously. As I said, it's why I didn't include those pieces in the emergency. But as it relates to pretrial detention, I'm really worried about the vast majority of victims in our city of violent crime are Black residents. And so we have to take both concerns seriously. It's always a matter of balance, of justice, of making sure that people who are alleged or charged with a crime have dignity and justice and the right to a fair trial. And it's also important that victims' concerns are taken seriously. And I look forward to working with Councilor Lewis George on the permanent bill to figure out how else we can constructively partner on this issue.
Let me quickly go to the phone lines. Jackson calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon. I'm sorry.
Quickly, we've got a very little time. What's on your mind?
We need justice, police authority. We need the mayor to step up when things are happening. I have three young sons, and I'm not trying to lose them to anything. Mm-hmm. There's no presence. There's nothing going on. People are driving with Maryland tags, paper tags, all kinds of tags. Tinted windows. We need somebody to step up. Please and thank you.
Jackson, thank you.
Get it.
Thank you so much. Real quick, Councilmember Pinto, one of the other concerning things that are in this bill, I was particularly struck by the new provision to allow police chases in certain circumstances. What are those circumstances? We know that in this city there has been a history of police chases that when they're chasing suspects that have ended badly.
Mm-hmm. And first, let me just say thank you, Jackson, so much for calling in. I hear you. I'm with you. We work with the police to make sure that they have what they need to pursue these illegal tags, which are not legal. And they have pulled over and pursued 1,200 cases this year alone of illegal tags. And I know that's going to continue and that we have to do more to get dangerous cars off the road. But in terms of police chases, this is a really important component. In D.C., we have a restrictive police chase policy, which essentially says, look, if there is a suspect fleeing, if it's not a violent crime, you can't chase them. If there are any other alternatives that you can locate the suspect, take those. And even if you get through those two pieces, you have to make sure that you can do everything you can to try to protect the suspect or suspects and the surrounding community. And those safeguards are really important to make sure that we don't have police chases that are going to result in injury to either suspects or the community. As you can imagine, in an urban center, when police are driving quickly chasing, that could lead to harm. But what happened was the police department was interpreting the new language of the police reform bill as effectively disallowing them from ever engaging in a chase. And I do not believe that was anyone on the council's viewpoint or plan to say that we have a no chase policy in D.C. It was just to clarify that other alternatives should be considered and the safety of the public and the suspect should be considered. And so my bill yesterday was really more of a clarifying amendment that I was able to work with Councilmember Lewis George and Councilmember Allen on to adjust the policy so that the police department was on page with what the legislative intent was.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you have real quick, Keith. Go right ahead.
Real quick question, yes, about juveniles. Tell us a little bit about what's happening with juveniles, because what I'm noticing with juveniles and what I see is an issue with DYRS allowing juveniles who've been convicted of a crime out earlier than their sentence. but that's not what this bill addresses. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. So there are a number of pieces, as I talked about, that we're working on a permanent basis. This bill was specifically the items, and to pass emergency legislation, it has to be things that don't have a cost, and that I believe that we had a hearing on and that we'd heard from the public and that I thought could get passed to make a difference this summer. You're absolutely right that there's a lot more work to do with DYRS, and that's one of my focuses for the permanent legislation, to make sure that when kids are in our custody as a city, what are we doing to make sure that they are being rehabilitated? What are we doing to help set them up for success when they come back home? What are the policies of letting somebody out early? Those are all things that we are looking at with the permanent legislation. But again, this is a targeted emergency bill to implement things right now that we had done sufficient research on and heard from the community on, and hoped could make a difference in driving down crime this summer.
Councilmember Brooke Pinto from Ward 2, thank you so much for your time. I'm sure that we will have an opportunity to discuss this further after the signature, and even as this legislation develops into a permanent law later on this fall. Again, thank you so very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. The original Quiet Storm on WHUR with John Mons is coming up next. We are going to continue this conversation on SiriusXM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about the D.C. crime bill passed by the D.C. Council just yesterday and now awaiting the signature of D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser. We continue our discussion with Washington Post reporter Keith Alexander, and also joining the conversation, Sam P.K. Collins, staff writer with the Washington Informer. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Keith, let me get your thoughts on the conversation that we just had with the council member.
First of all, you know, it's very interesting. When you saw where my questions were coming from, I was trying to get more information as to where she's getting her data that supports the ideas that they put through for this 90-day measure. It seems, from people I talk to, it seems like it's a good start. You know, I talked to prosecutors who applaud this. I talked to defense attorneys who are now saying this now means that they will have a much difficult time getting individuals who are being held based on allegations to be released. And as you already brought up, that often means black and brown skin individuals. So I'm curious as to how this is going to go. But again, it's only a 90-day. It we can see, if we can measure, engage, just how this works over this 90 days. At least it's something during the summer, which is a traditionally high crime period.
But, you know, Sam, you know, Keith makes an interesting point about, you know, the hard numbers. But do you believe that this emergency legislation is driven less by hard numbers and the public perception and pressure put on the council and the mayor to do something?
I mean, it's less so about what I believe and more about what I've seen. It's definitely driven by the pressure, the public pressure. We've seen council members like Zachary Parker of Ward 5 who've taken on harder positions over the last few weeks in response to what he's seen in his community. Over the last couple of days, he's spoken about carjackings, 12-year-olds wielding guns, things of that nature, and it's encouraged him to support the crime bill, as it is called, or as it has been called. So, and just even in response to concerned constituents who've chided him for taking on this position, you know, he pushed back, saying that he answers to Ward 5 residents and not people coming from Maryland and Virginia and not from internet trolls or whoever else. And that's pretty much a snide remark, not a snide remark, but it's more so an allusion to what some people would describe as, you know, activists who over the last few years have taken on what people might call a soft approach. Because as you mentioned, Harold, there is a lot of frustration with crime. So people are looking to the council to do something out of frustration and out of just anger about what's pretty much been happening.
Yeah, and I think that we saw also this week that Council Chair Phil Mendelson, who certainly gave a lot of pushback to the mayor. There was a lot of, you know, back and forth, and I'm not going to get into the political hot potato, but I think he did make an interesting point, Keith, when he was saying that a lot of people are blaming the council, or at least said that they do not care. And again, that is that emotional frustration. You know, that's not balls and strikes, Keith. That is somebody down the street got robbed. Okay.
Well, and his comments were so striking to me because he basically said DC police are not doing enough. But I've interviewed him recently, just a month or two, or about 3 months ago. And he said the U.S. Attorney's Office, the federal prosecutors, weren't doing enough.
Yeah.
That's what he told me. So I'm curious as to where all this is coming from. It's like, you know, every 3 months he's changing as to who is not doing enough. But I guess his response is, whoever's not doing enough is not us. Mm-hmm.
You know, Sam, what do you think about this issue of, as the council member said, clarifying the pursuit regulations or laws in the district? As I said to the council member, we have seen how police pursuits in the district can end badly. They can, you know, they can end badly for suspects. They can end badly for innocent bystanders. Balance that with the public saying, you got to catch these folks. You know, if you see them and you can chase them, you got to do it. Your thoughts about that, Sam?
No doubt. And, you know, in answering that question, I just want to bring to light what Councilmember Lewis George told me yesterday morning. She called the emergency bill related to that premature, but technical, or rather technical, but premature.
Right.
And later on during the council hearing, Councilmember Robert White, he brought up his observation that the examples that MPD used to make that point didn't quite meet the threshold of what would necessitate a change in the law. Because if a six-year-old passenger is being in the car while somebody is carjacking it, you know, then that more than necessitates the need for a chase, you know, for a pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
Or if somebody is, you know, in the commission of a robbery while, you know, the car is being carjacked or while they're taking it for a robbery right after, then of course that necessitates it. So MPD using those as examples, you know, doesn't quite meet the threshold from what I heard the council member say. So you know, even though it seems more political than anything else, and you got to keep in mind the origin of the original legislation. It came in the aftermath of Karan Hilton Brown's death during the pursuit. And we already know that corridor in which he was killed is a very hot corridor politically, you know. And right now there's just a lot going on. So the lines get blurred between, you know, public safety out of genuineness or public safety out of a need to prove a point, you know.
Yeah. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about D.C.'s emergency crime bill, not signed yet by the mayor, but passed by the D.C. Council yesterday. You know, Keith, one of the things that I did not know, and I was particularly struck by this yesterday, was that strangulation was not considered a felony beforehand.
Here's the thing. I've been covering crime down the courthouse. I can't tell you the number of strangulation cases that I've covered. And that to me came out of completely left field. And it goes back to what you were saying before. A lot of this seems a little cosmetic to just address issues. I don't remember. Who's out here strangling people? It's guns and stabbing, but mostly guns. I can't tell you the last time I saw a case of someone being strangled.
Yeah, and we can get into, you know, the definition, but it was my understanding that if you're strangled, you're dead. But I'm assuming that that is not it. That may be an assault with strangulation where the victim lived. But and like I said, I'm not going to kind of parse the definition. But I did find that to be a little strange, particularly when I would imagine that this may be applicable to issues regarding domestic violence. Go ahead, Sam.
I was in the Wilson building yesterday, most of the day during this legislative hearing, and I had a chance to speak with a Ward 7 resident who, in fact, was coming out of a divorce. She alluded to this portion of the bill, you know, and just speaking about her experience, just backing up what she said about domestic violence cases. And an interesting note that I want to bring up briefly is that shooting of a firearm indiscriminately and the strangulation felony are actually remnants of the revised criminal code act that went to Congress and got struck down. So it's very ironic how, you know, these are the elements of the revised criminal code act that were not talked about in all the hoopla about it among, you know, the hard on crime, you know, people, but it still got struck down, and it just happened to make its way back, you know, when it's convenient. So I just wanted to put that out there.
I also think with the strangulation part is probably not called a homicide. I think what this really is for assault cases, particularly domestic violence assault cases, where if the victim can prove that his or her attacker strangled, even though they were killed, but just act of strangulation, that means that the charges will be enhanced. I think, now that I think about it, I think that's what they're going after. That's so much a homicide, but for an assault case,
right,
it would be a heightened assault charge.
Yeah. I'm asking both of you to speculate. I would have thought that the mayor would have signed this immediately because obviously this is a public safety victory for her, but also a political victory for her. And certainly, who knows, she could be signing it right now, even as we're talking about it, or she could be planning a very small ceremony to, again, highlight the importance of it. But, I'm just a little, surprised that it's not all, it's not already signed.
I'm not surprised. I'm wondering if she's now getting some last-minute meetings with individuals just to make sure that she's completely clear, everyone's clear as to what this means for judges and prosecutors and police. I think she's just probably maybe doing a little bit more due diligence,
mm-hmm,
just to be clear before she goes and signs this in order. I am sure it will be signed before the weekend, or the next week. But I think she's just making sure that she's completely clear by all the parties involved, all the stakeholders, as to what this means.
Yeah, she did not at the press conference today for the All-Star Soccer League, the Major League Soccer weekend. She did not want to talk about this at all. Sam Ford from Channel 7 actually said that she had changed her mind, but she just really was not addressing it. So I guess we'll have to wait and see, what she says down the road. But, I guess I want to go back to this pre-trial
mm-hmm
issue, because Ward 4 council member Janice Lewis George was quite passionate about this, and Vincent Gray for that particular amendment was supportive of her. And again, Keith, I speak about the numbers versus the perception. And right. and there has been discussion about this outside the boundaries of Washington, D.C. There's been discussion in Maryland about some of the laws regarding juveniles, and prosecutors are saying that there are things that they cannot do. And we do know, particularly in D.C., former Chief Conte used to say this, Keith, all the time, that a lot of the crimes that are happening are the happening people. From people. They're the same people. Is it possible that this... arguably this most controversial part of this emergency bill could make a difference the next time a judge looks at a suspect and says, you know what, I've seen you before, twice before, maybe even three times before. It's time for you to get locked up until you go to trial.
And I think that, and also we're talking about, I think they're really focused on individuals who are charged with violent crime.
Right.
Not individuals who, maybe a drug offense or something like that. If you had a previous conviction of a violent crime and you have now been rearrested, now the chances of you going home until trial are now lessened. The irony is I just covered the case involving the guy at Catholic University. The guy who was charged in his killing, they found an ankle bracelet monitor in his home that had been broken off.
Yeah.
Now, so there is something to say, but what I've also noticed is that there are a lot of young people, particularly the juveniles are more so the ones who are reoffending while on GPS monitoring, much more so than the adults. So I think this will really have much more of an impact on them more so than the adults.
Yeah.
Usually the adults have already gone home, they're off paper, and that's when they reoffend. But it's the juveniles who are on paper and who are in between trials and actually have been reoffending. That's what we've been noticing.
Sam, you have your ears to the ground and covering your beat, and we heard earlier today in this conversation from a D.C. caller who, for example, was talking about, illegal cars, expired paper tags, expired regular tags and tinted windows. And certainly that car issue is one. But I think overall, what are they telling you as far as this legislation? And just their feeling about crime in the city.
Well, the opinions run the gamut. You have residents who are very grateful about the legislation, and once again, they're very frustrated, not only about carjackings and violent crime, but to your point about traffic safety, about people with exorbitant amount of tickets, running amok on the roads. Causing traffic accidents or anything of that sort. But you also have those who are very concerned about the possibility of us, reverting back to 1994, mm-hmm. That's a pressing concern. And you have those who look back to budget season, which wrapped up a few weeks ago, during which the council did its best to rectify the cuts that Mayor Bowser imposed in her budget proposal. And so you have people who are in a camp that even though they're frustrated with crime, they're looking at the bigger elephant in the room, which is the cuts of social services in some aspects of D.C. life that are affecting people. So once again,
when you say going back to 1994, can you explain to the listeners what do you mean by that for those people who might have been here in 1994?
No doubt. So 1994, the passage of what they call the crime bill, when we're talking about...
The federal crime bill.
Federal crime bill that engineered mass incarceration, that took it to a different level, where people went away for various offenses. We're talking about decades. Some people might very well still be in prison. And, incarceration has destroyed generations of families. Some people would argue with you that the children who are running amok in the streets right now are the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of those who have been incarcerated and taken away from their families. So incarceration is an intergenerational problem, and the concern among D.C. residents is that by putting away, you know, D.C. residents away for a long time with these laws, we run the risk of pretty much regurgitating what has happened in the 90s. And it happens, you know, by instilling fear in people, by taking them away or keeping them away from the fact that, you know, over the last decade or so, it has become harder to live in D.C., that affordable housing is harder to get into, that SNAP benefits fluctuate, that the quality of an education in D.C. Is hard to access because of a lottery system that prioritizes a certain percent, a certain group of students. You know, there are a lot of factors in mind that are underneath all of the crime that is happening. And as it relates to the youth, we are 3 years since the start of a pandemic, and that a lot of young people have not recovered from. So we went from being very understanding of what they were going through to pretty much being visceral in our reaction. And once again, it's out of a understandable fear of the unknown and what people have seen. But at the very same time, you have people in the community who want to remind us of what happened last time when we didn't look at the entire picture.
And I think you make such an excellent point, Sam, because in many discussions on this program, you know, particularly after a particularly violent weekend, and we sit here and it just seems to me that there has been, as you just pointed out, a shift in how the public is reacting. Certainly, conversations on this program are certainly unscientific, but I've seen and heard that from our listeners that whole discussion about a holistic approach to dealing with crime, particularly in a predominantly African-American communities, they have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And now they're just saying we need to lock these kids up because somebody down the street got shot and somebody was leaning on my car and cussed me out and showed me a gun in their waistband. And we just continue to see black people killing black people, particularly young ones. And hear that argument shifting. And to your point, Sam, 1994, that was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And as Keith pointed out, people don't know or don't remember.
And also, I think a lot of things have changed in these past 3 years since the pandemic. I think you have these young people who were cooped up in their homes, and they were out there on social media, fighting with people on social media. As soon as the pandemic was lifted, everybody's on the streets. People are going back and these attacks involving social media. I think prior to social media, individuals had more tolerance. But now, prior to the pandemic, individuals had more tolerance. But since the pandemic, crime has risen, and people are now reacting to being locked up in their homes for over two years.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, and I know both of you, you know, cover D.C., but I do want to ask you about this big story that came out of Prince George's County just yesterday. The new superintendent or CEO, we're still trying to figure out what his title is going to be. But that notwithstanding, that Millard House II, the new head of the Prince George's County school system, wants metal detectors in all high schools and in 8 middle schools, as well as all students using clear book bags so that staff can see what's in the book bag. He was specifically talking about guns. You know, there was a gun, a student, 17-year-old, arrested in Central High School on the first day of summer school, in addition to probably, you know, a pen, pencils, notebook, he had a handgun. So your thoughts, Sam, about what the new head of Prince George's County Public Schools is proposing for metal detectors and clear book bags?
It's a start in terms of addressing the issue immediately, but I wonder what kind of holistic approach is going to be added to it, whether it is mitigating neighborhood conflicts, whether it's contacting parents or collecting data around who's most likely to carry guns, or, you know, aligning grades with history of criminality in students, anything that looks at it long term and gives us the bigger picture. You know, I do understand why this policy would be imposed, but, you know, we got to think long term in terms of like how to nip this in the bud and get at the real source of the issue.
And if I could just add this one real quick point.
Sure.
I was surprised that this policy has not already been effect. And I bet you a lot of your listeners were surprised as well. I'm surprised that Prince George's County does not already have metal detectors and in place in the high school. And that kind of surprised me.
I believe that at least the clear book bag issue has come up before, but did not go through. And just today, they announced some 10,000 book bags that are going to be passed out during their next back to school issue. But as we know, in Prince George's County, as relates to a great many things, and Prince George's County certainly is not alone, but you know, metal detectors, and we don't know what kind. Are we talking about wands? Are we talking about walkthroughs like they have at airports or the like, or other, you know, federal buildings? We don't have any clear information about how that exactly is going to work. But it appears that the superintendent House is coming in some 12 days now after, you know, getting on the job, and he's just put his foot down and he said, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to see how it all works out. And you know, and Keith, as you know,
Carol, do you know whether or not this new superintendent or CEO is coming from a school system that had metal detectors? Do you know anything about that?
That I don't know, but he came from Houston. That is where he came from, but I don't know the answer to whether or not they had metal detectors. But I would imagine, as he said, coming into town and taking on this position, that he was coming in to do a lot of listening. And you don't have to listen long to know that in Prince George's County, as we have seen this year and you know, over the past several weeks, and not just in Prince George's, but in the entire DMV, students bringing guns to school is an issue. We saw it in Montgomery County. We see it in the District of Columbia, and you know, you don't have to look too far back in the reporting this week to know that something needs to be done. But to that other point, Keith, and I was going to make, as you know, Washington Post today had a story about teens buying ghost guns mm-hmm. online. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that is something that Malik Aziz, the Prince George's County Police Chief, has spoken about since he came to town, about the growth in the confiscation of ghost guns from young people.
And that's what, you know, these gun tenders aren't going to grab that, right? Because I can bring in a piece, my boy can bring in a piece, my girl can bring in a third piece, we can get it all in school and assemble it, and now you have a working violent gun.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious as to how that's going to work, because you can assemble these guns by students bringing individual pieces whereby they might not cause concern individually by authorities who see it in the metal detector. So that's my concern. It's okay, how are they going to deal with ghost guns that are basically assembled piece by piece like Legos once inside the school?
Yeah. Sam, I'll let you have the last comment before we close out this conversation. Your final thoughts.
I wonder what's going to happen on the first day of school in the first few weeks. How will the book bag be disseminated? What would happen in instances where students wear regular book bags? If students because if I can recall correctly, there was a charter school in Northeast where students refused to come into school, and then later on those students were victims and perpetrators of a violent crime involving guns. So, you know, I wonder about cases like that when students would refuse to come into the school once they see the metal detectors, you know, on and working. You know, there are a lot of factors to keep in mind, but I do appreciate the attempt. I just hope that we get to more holistic efforts or measures.
Yeah. It's a tough row to hoe, as they say, and we will continue to pay attention not only to that story in Prince George's, but also what happens during the 90 days that this D.C. emergency crime bill goes into effect, and as well as what happens when they begin to look at more permanent legislation. All we can do is continue to watch. Keith Alexander, Sam P.K. Collins, thank you both for participating in this conversation. Always enjoy having you guys on the line.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for having
me. Also, we want to thank Ward 2 Councilmember Brooke Pinto for participating in the conversation. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, July 12th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.